From failure to power, from collaboration to money, from participation to equity,
we want to poke and provoke conversations about the key themes we need to address as urban resilience practitioners, researchers, and policymakers.
Welcome to Urban Resilience Dialogues. I am Karina.
And I am Chiara.
And in this fourth episode of Urban Resilience Dialogues, we're talking about the role of experiments in urban resilience. And for this episode, we've partnered with the European Urban Knowledge Network, EUKN. The focus on experiments is not new, as concepts such as urban labs, tactical or pop-up urbanism, or meanwhile use, these are increasingly being used to denote the need to tackle urban challenges in innovative ways. In this episode, we want to explore the overlap between such approaches to urban experimentation and the urgent need for climate adaptation. Experiments bring the promise of urban transformation towards more sustainable cities, but they also pose questions about learning from failure. What do we do when the experiment doesn't work or doesn't scale?
And to explore this all with us, we are joined by Federico Savini. Federico is Associate Professor in Environmental Planning, Institutions, and politics at the University of Amsterdam. His research studies if and how radical innovation brings about institutional change. He has coordinated two large European projects that set up, tested, and assessed real-life urban experiments in the field of energy use and urban development. He is also founder of a housing cooperative in Amsterdam called the New Commons that experiments with ecological forms of collective living. So, Federico, to kick off our dialogue, can you tell us a bit about yourself and how you work in urban planning as a practitioner and researcher relates to aspects of urban resilience?
Yes, first of all, thank you, Chiara and Corina, for inviting me to this podcast. I'm very happy to be here. I am an urban planner, but I have to say that I enter urban planning or the world of planning from the side of the door. I was an urban sociologist and then a political sociologist, actually, for a long time. I was very much interested in how people behave somehow in urban space and how urban space changed the behavior of people. So I was studying really how people consume, move in the city, and how the urban space can impact the way these people consume and move in the city. Now, indeed, I'm an urban planner, and I'm more engaged with urban designers, architects, experts in urban technologies and infrastructures. And what I research is indeed how experiments, real-life experiments that takes place in cities generate new institutions. And by institutions, I mean new frameworks, new policy frameworks, but also new regulations, and of course, new social norms. Those, let's say, soft institutions that we all internalize in our daily, everyday behavior. So what makes us choosing for one thing rather than another when we buy things? What makes us choosing for one particular travel choice rather than another? So this is a bit my focus. As you already introduced, I'm also founder of a housing cooperative in Amsterdam. This is indeed one of the real life experiments that I try to set up. It is indeed something that we see as an experiment. I'm doing it with many other people, and maybe I will have the chance to tell more about this project later in this podcast.
Yeah, as you just mentioned, so you wear this double hat, that of an academic and that of a practitioner, and you're also involved in urban experience, as you just said. So can you tell us more about your practice and the relationship you have with experiments, or maybe the approach of action-oriented action?
There is a general misunderstanding of what the role of science is in society. One of these misunderstandings, which comes back from, you know, the modern approach to what we call positivist science, is that scientists produce knowledge through their laboratory research and then transfer this knowledge to society. This is a top-down way to think at the role of science. We action-oriented researchers see it in a different way. We first of all start from the assumption that knowledge is produced in society, in practices, real life practices of doing things together and solving problems together. And this knowledge is there basically, but just need to be interpreted and somehow organized into concepts, into theories, into frameworks that can be then reused somewhere else to, in fact, solve similar problems. So the role of scientists here is not that of producing knowledge, but it's indeed that of digesting it somehow. So observing, analyzing it, interpreting, and also framing it in different ways to make it understandable for both the people who use this knowledge, that produce this knowledge, and others in other places. So action-oriented research has this fundamental assumption as a driver. Of course, what happens in my research is also that we as scholars try to actively set up situations where knowledge gets produced together with other groups in society, citizens, governments, corporations, et cetera, et cetera. So when we try to set up these processes, we use methodologies which indeed are not simply oriented to grasp data, but also to think how these situations can be created and organized in order to produce useful knowledge for particular types of problems.
I really enjoyed that introduction. I think that links so well with what I was going to ask you next. And it's this sort of theme around challenges and opportunities around experimentation. And in a way, we know that urban experiments are not new. So the practice of trying something out, learning from it, doing it again or not, is as old as urban settlements themselves. And, you know, to go back a bit in time, this legacy of urban experiments comes from lab studies that have set out to falsify a hypothesis. So as you were mentioning, the legacy of positivist science. And this really saw the city as a laboratory, right? So in a way, that boundary between the field and the lab disappeared. And then I'm reminded of the Chicago School sociologists that put forward that what makes a city experimental is the way in which understanding how urban change happens is then linked to policy interventions and reform. So here there's a really strong link between experiments and their governance. And I'd really like to explore this in conversation with you, because we've seen a recent trend of seeing urban experiments as maybe the antidote to traditional urban planning approaches that, you know, we call them top-down, expert-led, centrally decided. And there's this growing recognition that the old ways of doing things are unfit for the purpose of responding to challenges such as climate change or urban inequality or demographic shifts. So what, in your view, do you think is the case for experimentation here? But also, what do you think we mean by experimentation in this new understanding? And what might be the opportunities that this opens up for urban resilience?
This is a very crucial question, and I would like to make it clear right at the beginning. The word experiment in the urban context, indeed, as you correctly point out, gained a lot of momentum in the last 15 years. Actually, when we look at the way policymakers, in particular European policymakers, started to talk about urban laboratories, we see by the 2006, 2007, but much more prominently in 2008, during and after the global financial crisis, we see a large increase in the way the experimental jargon gets used in urban policymaker. But as you rightly point out, experimentation in practice happened already before. People and governments and organizations always try to define, prototype creative solutions to their problems. But we were not calling them experiments. We were calling them often social innovation in more broad general terms. So the question is, why do we call them now experiment? And what is the meaning of this word? And is that always a good thing or also not in some cases? My take on this is that experiments have been a way to frame particular types of social innovation. a way to frame them as particularly useful to solve specific problems. Now, this means that there is a politics of this framing. So some actors might look at the same practices, not at as experiments which are bottom-up, but they might look at them as, for example, more top-down prototypes, while others might look instead at other practices of social innovation as very experimental, even though they're not defined as experiment by the mainstream policy arenas. So what we see indeed is that also the use of the word experiment has been gaining momentum, especially when the role of ICTs and urban technology became very prominent in urban policymaking. So many of the experimentation narrative was attached to the smart city narrative in many cities, because in fact, there we had a particular tool, a technology that needed to be tested also in the relation with, particular urban context. So the word experiment, in fact, captured very well the way these practices, which were mediated by the technology, could be organized also with the role of particular professional experts that were able to use these technologies. So experiment, in fact, became a tool that does not even identify purely a bottom-up practice, totally self-organized. It's not the case. Actually, experiment involve a lot of degree of organization and a lot of particular expertise that is oriented to indeed combine different tools in particular places. And that's why we also use the word living lab. It's a laboratory, so it's a space of expertise. It's a space where technical expertise is very important. But this laboratory is the city itself or some areas of the city. So I have to say, to sum up, I think we should be critical on what we call experiment and why we do so, because there might be practices that are not called experiment, but they are very experimental and hold a great potential to solve the social and ecological problems of our time.
Definitely. And I think you touch upon something there that I would like us to explore a bit more. So, you know, this challenge to taking an experimental approach. And I think in my mind, it's an approach because I see it in my experience that there's a lot of appetite for experiments. But many times this appetite actually comes from the same mindset. So people want something that has a predictable outcome, that has impact indicators that we can set, you know, when we write the project proposal. So in a way, there's such a big desire for experiments, but without the practice of experimentation. And you kind of touched on that as well. And if we go back to the origins of lab studies, they usually had, you know, specific instruments, they had a controlled environment, they had a specific measurement of the change that they were trying to observe. But this is so much harder when we talk about urban experiments. And you know, as urban practitioners and researchers, both Chiara and I, we've also encountered this reluctance to experimentation. So when you talk to organizations that are actually really risk averse and very often path dependent. So we're curious about your experience with this. What are the challenges to experimentation in your view?
Experiments are give, first of all, an idea of control. And that's very important because they are extremely instrumental. So they have a very clear goal usually, or a clear ambition, or a clear understanding of a problem that they want to address. And also, they have also a clear idea of where they should be tested, these solutions. So they have an area or a crossroad or a particular housing block or a particular neighborhood in mind. So this gives to policymakers, but also corporations, especially in times of uncertainty, economic uncertainty, like the global financial crisis 2008, gives them a feeling that they can experiment, that they can try out solutions with lower risks. So already calling things experiments by policymakers already made a lot of organizations getting involved in this experiment, exactly because their perception of the risk was lower. In their views, it was easier to test a solution in a particular location at a particular time with particular tools rather than thinking in terms of systemic solutions. Let me give you an example. If you want to think in terms of housing affordability and in terms of provision of affordable housing in cities, you may choose an experimental approach which looks at a particular area which has a low affordability rate and try there to, you know, include different types of houses and involve the citizens to do that, or involve the housing providers and the owners, trying to, in this area, to prototype different types of housing that is more affordable. But this avoids the question, or like distracts from the question of the systemic view on the housing market in a particular city, which is much more challenging and indeed risky and much more politically controversial to think in terms of rental policies for the whole city or the whole country. Is much more controversial to think in terms of long-term housing production because it involves a lot of resources. So these questions are somehow bypassed by focusing on the experimental approach within a particular neighborhood at a particular time. So this, what I'm trying to say is that calling it experiment and building experiment somehow has had the effect to reduce the perception of risk by many stakeholders. It also made it easier, for example, for public authorities to also target funding for prototyped solution. In 2010 to 2015, we see a lot of funds specifically targeted for experiment in particular areas of need. These funds were not structural funds given to solve problems at larger scales, but were very, very targeted to particular urban areas. This is also why cities became the target of this funding, and that's why we also started to talk about urban living labs in many cases.
But you were also talking about risk, and now I would like to discuss a bit the idea of practicing experimentation and linking to what you were mentioning, that, well, the process is evidence-based, but the question is like, where do you start experimenting and who takes the risk? I mean, for example, in technological research and development, a lot of the times we see governments driving the investments, framed under defense, military purposes, or health, as we recently witnessed. For example, this is what led to the development of GPS technologies and many other technologies that are now commercially available. And then you've got aggressive venture capital driving a lot of innovation as well. But somehow, it is not that obvious in urban experiments, as they seem to be predominantly led by academics working in partnership with communities and practitioners as you, or led by progressive municipalities sometimes. And if we talk about the co-benefits of urban experiments as preventive interventions, this might not be visible for years, if not decades. So, for example, if we look at connections between increased active mobility and decrease in lifestyle-related health issues. So coming back to the question, who take the risk or who should take the risk, in your opinion, in urban experiments, when the benefits often require long periods of investment and patience?
I think this is the essential political challenge of experimentation. Once we talk about risks, so economic, social, environmental risks, we talk about justice. We talk about how these risks are distributed, who takes them. So it is essentially a political issue of experimentation. And I think it is extremely important. If we look at the way experiments are built, and just to open a bracket, there are different kinds of experiments that are, in fact, started and initiated by different agencies. Like you mentioned, some are corporate, some are more public-oriented, but some other may be civic-based. So once we look at how experiments are started, we have, first of all, to ask why and for what reason it has been decided to undertake an experimental process in this particular area now. Already the decision to undertake an urban experiment or to build a lab is a political decision. And what we see is that some of these labs are often actually undertaken in areas where there is already a higher potential of success. So in order to reduce the risk, many of the experiment takes place where there is already something that can be used to build up a new solution or a prototype. This is a political challenge because it excludes areas where there might be high needs, but less potential in terms of success of that particular experiment. So this is the first choice that is made. Already, of course, we enter the field of risk. So once the experiment or the experiment is set up, then there is a whole governance behind it, which is oriented to define the roles of these different particular actors. Usually we, in the mainstream literature on experimentation, we identify actors in the triple or quadruple helixes. These are concepts that are used often to identify family of actors, usually knowledge, government, market, and civic actors. These are the, let's say, the more simplified map of different family of actors. So once we build an experiment, then we need to see how risks are distributed, but also how returns are distributed. The problem of returns and risks is particularly evident in those experiments, which I call techno experiments. So experiments which involve a strong role of technology, which is the majority of these experiments. There, the challenge is very, very high because, in fact, the cost of setting up the experiment, both financial and social and in terms of time, are very high. It takes a long time to set it up, to see how it evolves and how the success, let's say, turns out. But the returns on those investments are sometimes appropriated by those actors that own those technologies. This is evident in many cases when the object of experimentation is data on mobility patterns. We see that these experiments are also, for example, on self-driving cars or shared mobilities. We see that those data, those results are in fact appropriated by the corporate side of these experiments. But this is a bit of a known story. It happens the same with, you know, with patents for vaccines or patents for online tools, or we see that. I mean, Mariana Mazzucato has wrote several books, one of the most famous economists of our times, several books about the role that the state has in promoting innovation and also the loss that the state has in when this innovation gets appropriated or marketized by corporate actors. The same works with urban experiments, in my view. So we can, shared mobility is one of probably the most evident example of this. The building of shared mobility systems involved a lot of attention to research, surveying, a lot of choice of key infrastructures, a lot of infrastructure that needs to be placed. And this shared mobility information then get, of course, used by companies that provide these services in order to enlarge these services. Some people might think there is nothing wrong with it, and I understand that. But I also think that, as you correctly point out, the risk of these experiments need to make very, the risk and gains need to be made very explicit on where they go, in fact.
And I think it links very well to my next question on how we practice experimentation, that of valuing it as a process, but also being aware of the ethical implications of urban experiments. On whom are urban experiments carried out? What if it doesn't work? And by implication, who decides what is it to be an experiment and sets the boundaries, maybe? So here we're curious about your thoughts on how we can walk that line and how do you involve maybe end users in the process of experimentation in an ethical way? Maybe you can share with us how you position yourself and the way you build relationships, maybe with the communities you work with. What is your position on that?
Yes, the ethical question is essential, and it is indeed also a political issue, as I just explained. I think the most important thing that should be done in order to set up innovation in an experimental way in a just way is to involve the communities, first of all, in defining the priorities and the problems that need to be addressed by those experiments. So this means not deciding that a particular area all of a sudden becomes a testbed for a particular technology, but actually finding out what are the issues that those citizens in those areas really care about. Mm-hmm. Because their priority might be very different from those of the corporate actors. So it's essential, in fact, to involve those communities to define the problems on the basis of which those experiments are organized. This is the very first step, and is the, you know, the condition sine qua non, to put it in a Latin way, without which we don't have a just experiment. Now, the second step is, in fact, to involve those same people together with other actors in the setup of that experiment. So clarifying what are the goals of it, first of all, and what are the time frames for those goals to be met or realized. This is already a discussion that in many cases does not happen so often, actually. We see that those steps are usually rushed because already there is an idea of what type of solutions need to be generated, as was said before. So that processes require a lot of time, and time involves higher risks, as you just pointed out. So the role of the public authorities is essential also to take up those risks. The role of the public authorities is also very important, not only for that reason, but also because with them it's possible to link the experiment to the broad systemic perspective, to the policy perspective. So only through a careful role of public authorities, we are able to prototype solutions and learn from the solution in order to upscale them at the level of the policy. Now, let me give you an example of all what I just said by talking about a recent experiment that I'm involved in, which is this housing cooperative in Amsterdam called the Nieuwe Meent, which is the new commons in Dutch, essentially. This is a project of that has the ambition to produce 37 affordable and social housing units in Amsterdam. And we want to produce these units in a way that is neither private, so based on individual private ownership, nor public, so nor social housing regulated by the public. It's a cooperative and it's fully autonomous. So these people, which will be about 55 residents, have the full ownership and the full management of this building, which then they rent to themselves. So it's a community of living, which is based on a principle of commune. How we set it up is with those people. We start right at the beginning with a vision. So we talk about the priorities. How do we understand ecological living? How do we understand low impact living? How do we understand affordability? What is it affordable for the community of inhabitants? We do it with them. We start already thinking in terms of vision. But then we go on and we try to involve as many people as possible and the future inhabitants as possible to define also their architecture, the architecture of the space, the design, the way energy systems work, the way they are owned or co-owned. So it is a process that is fully participatory and it requires a lot of energy and time. So what we do here is really constructing the experiment together, not trying to, in fact, test solutions which are already predefined. There is nothing predefined. There is actually just a group of people trying to together build a vision of their way of life and also build an understanding of this, of the ecological impact of this way of life. So I think this is one of the radical experiments. I would define it that way because it goes at the roots of the very meaning of the experiment, which is what do we want to experiment with? What is the problem that we want to address? And then it engages in a long-term process.
In the introduction, we mentioned tactical and pop-up urbanism in the introduction, right? We could summarize the concept as implementing short-term actions to bring long-term change. So in Paris, for example, where I live, we've seen it happen during the COVID-19 pandemic with the operation of pop-up bike lanes, for example. and now they are made permanent. So I was wondering, there are so many experiments that have been implemented and well documented in cities around the world on every subject or just about that we can think of. But when working on the resilience of our cities also mean that we need to get ready, or at least being able to act when the unexpected strikes. So maybe that's a tricky question, but how do we mobilize all this experience, all these experiments, when time comes to improvise?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question for policymakers. They would love to have that answer, because they see many things happening in city. I have to say, the example of what you just mentioned of reclaiming the street for slow mobility is one of the most common and cited example of successful tactical urbanism. And it happened indeed in Milan, in Amsterdam, in Copenhagen, in Berlin, all kind of cities I had to think about, at least in Europe. So what is the secret to make permanent change? That's indeed the key question. I think there what happened is that there was a very good capacity to identify the particular need that a large mass of population needed in a particular place. And this capacity made it extremely, extremely powerful to prototype those solutions, because there was immediately a large response by the public, let's say, by the users of those streets. So what happened then is that government were quite prepared to, in fact, capture those responses and say, okay, well, we see there is a need here. There is a need for an urban policy on slow mobility. Let's make it one. And then, in fact, in Paris, we had all kind of other examples, like the 15-minute city and all kind of other policies that were oriented to make use of those learning of those tactical experiments. So in fact, I would summarize this capacity with two words, I would say. One is preparedness, which is a word that identifies the capacity of a system or a municipality to react to positive and negative stress. So be prepared to react to also positive incentives and stresses, like the one you just mentioned. And the other is a term that, for example, Nicolas Taleb has written about, that it's anti-fragility, so anti-fragile, which is not resilience as the title of this podcast, but I think it's even better, because it gives the possibility to explain the capacity of a system or a city to adapt and learn to innovation in a rapid times, not to go back to an initial state, flexibly, but actually to change and evolve in a better way. So to be prepared and to be anti-fragile are virtuous properties of a particular urban governance system, and not all of them are good for this. Finally, I have to say there is one other important condition that I think is very important, especially in the field of ecological innovation, is the political responsiveness of a particular municipality. It's the degree to which a community is able to politicize, to make political particular projects. So if you look at Milan, is a context that I know a bit better, and at the same type of experiments that you mentioned, so tactical urbanism for slow mobility, we see that those tactical experiments were connected by a very strong movement, social movement, of urban dwellers that were for years advocating for more cycling lanes and pedestrian space in Milan. There was a huge organization by network of these associations to advocate for this type of experiment to be upscaled at the level of the city. This is essential, the capacity to politicize this experiment, to make them political concern for the democratic arenas of decision making. And I think these political movements are one of the reasons why a system can be prepared and anti-fragile. So here we move from the technological corporate side of experiment to the political side of experiment and the political subjects of these experiments.
And I think that's a great segue to our final section, which is looking at these tricky issues around scaling, but also learning from failure. And, you know, we've been talking about experimentation and in the context of preparedness and anti-fragility. And I really like the way you brought in these two concepts. And I think there's something in here about how might these two concepts help shift almost like the goal of urban experiments. So actually, they're about how do we go about transforming the very way we live in cities? But I would like us to spend a bit of time to explore how do we really go from good practices to wider systemic change at scale. And we had a very tricky question for you, but are there any inspiring examples that come to mind that you would like to share with us? What have you seen where you've actually kind of gone, wow, like actually this has scaled and it's pretty impressive what they've done?
I mean, I know many cases of upscaling, impressive upscaling. But I'm not sure yet whether the result of this upscaling will be as good as I expect, but this is another issue. But the upscaling happened. I mean, there are experiments on smart grids, for example, which were upscaled very much. Experiment on circular economy and circular productions that were upscaled in Amsterdam, for example. We started with many specific plots to build a circular business hubs, which then informed actually a citywide policy on circularity. Again, the results might be different than what was intended, but there was a very quick upscaling there. The mobility examples that Chiara just mentioned are another very good example of how tactical urbanism can be upscaled at a citywide policy, at least at the beginning of it. I think many housing cooperatives, for example, developed in Switzerland or in Germany, have been also upscaled in big federations of housing cooperatives and also very large scale cooperatives that produce a lot of houses at affordable prices. In Switzerland, there are many of these cases, but also the Mietshäuser Syndikat in Germany is another case of a federation of housing cooperative that started from very small scale experiments, in fact. As you see, these are all examples. Many of these are examples where technology is not so central. They are not only about shared mobility, which is also, by the way, a sector where a lot of successful experiments have been conducted. But there are examples of people, you know, trying different ways of living in cities and then stimulated citywide and nationwide policies. Why this happened? As I said, there are many reasons related to the preparedness and anti-fragility and democracy of a particular context. But I think that, as I said before, the degree to which experiments raise political issues, so issues that are political in the sense that they are collective for the whole collectivity in a particular city or a particular region, is essential to determine whether they will become successful or not. So I think experiments are not just experiments, basically. They are also political tools that need to be mobilized. And there should be a political vision behind that. And this is also the task of governments, in many cases, that initiate them. So I wish, in fact, that these experiments would be framed within a vision, especially now in the new frontier of experimentation, which is the ecological challenge.
Yeah, and I think that's a very interesting and a great reminder, you know, that actually things are changing and there are positive changes. And I think sometimes it's really easy to forget that actually there's a lot of interesting examples and positive examples that can help us keep going. And I wanted to ask that question around positive examples, because the next question is around digging into a very tricky topic, that about the relationship between pilot projects and scaling. And we hear quite a lot, so from policymakers, from funding bodies especially, that there's a lack of bankable urban resilience projects at scale. And I think when we say at scale, we're looking at, you know, in the region of 10 million, name your currency, dollars, euros, pounds, whatever, 10 million plus. And yet, if we look at academic or grey literature, it seems like there's a lot of experimentation going. So we're really wondering what is going on here. Are the pilot experiments not scaling? And if so, do we need new scaling mechanisms? Or do we need to design experiments differently? And there was this quote that I once saw on the side of the building that comes to mind. And the quote said, the next big thing will be a lot of small things. So this also makes me think, how do we scale? Like, what does scale actually look like? And, you know, this quote talks so much more to the need for actually for quite small but interconnected and networked experiments. So in a way, ecosystems of experiments. Do you have any thoughts about how might we overcome this challenge of scaling?
Of course, as I said, I wish we can have a critical view on experimentation, because indeed the challenge is then how do these prototypes, which are defined at the level of a particular area in a particular context, can inform broad systemic and institutional change. That's the so-called upscaling challenge of the experiment. This challenge is yet an open challenge, because what we see is that first, in many cases, experiments don't manage to upscale because of different reasons, for funding, but also because they don't bring the results that were expected to bring. But also we see that in those cases when the experiments manage to upscale, somehow they change nature. They change their nature. So once you make the same experiment at a larger scale, somehow the effect that you obtained at a particular smaller scale is not anymore the same. There are all kind of other unwanted effects or externalities in some cases that are undesirable and were not expected. We also see, and this is a third problem of upscaling, that in many cases, experiments that were very successful in one particular area are not able to be replicated somewhere else because conditions are extremely different. In urban planning, we often witness this, weakness of the so-called policy transfer. With a colleague and a student of mine, we did a research which was published in the Journal of Urban Technology that defined two ways of upscaling of experiment. One, we define it as a Whirlpool model, and one, we define it as a Mosaic model. So we saw that there are experiments that have this Whirlpool effect where, you know, from a small scale, they kind of grow up, but always keeping their nature a bit. They basically do the same at the larger scale. And they start from a neighborhood, and then they become urban, and then, you know, the infrastructure and the prototypes that are developed, they become even international, sold somewhere else, prototyped, and, you know, implemented in other places. This is like something that just grows, you know, from the very core of the experiment. And it usually brings up a lot of money, of course. I mean, the grow requires a lot of resources to upscale. But there are also the same type of experiment that involve technologies that we understood to be more mosaics in the sense that they do not enlarge, but they replicate in the sense that they become a bit what your quote seems to suggest. They become networks of similar practices that inspire each other. I really believe that this is more likely to be the effective strategy in order to be very sensitive to context and to solve solutions where they're really, in the way they're really needed in particular situations. And also, they are the one that, just to go back to what Chiara mentioned before, are the one that have the lower risks to a certain extent. So they are more easily to be produced and more easily to be prototyped. So I think this is a very, let's say, hopeful way to think in terms of upscaling.
And to build on this, I have one final question around scaling, which is more around almost like how do we scale and learn from experiments? But at the same time, how do we address the fact that we rarely talk about failure, especially when it comes to experiments? So we see a lot of attention on best practice. And again, I'm reminded of a saying, I think it was from like a business or a management journal that said, best practice doesn't make you best, it makes you average. And there is some truth in that. So how do we learn from what doesn't work? And if we really value experimentation, what might need to change in the way we view success? And we're curious about your reflections on this. How might we learn from maybe, I don't know, worst practice?
I agree. Probably we learn much more from the worst practices than from the best practices. So also what we should start doing is to give visibility to, in fact, those practices that somehow don't manage to be upscaled while they had a very good intuitions, I think, in terms of their approaches. After all, the experiments that we talk about often are the best practices that we talk about often are those that involve a large amount of money, that involve infrastructural change, that involve a strong role of corporate actors, which are flashy, you know, in the news, and that are very easy to, they make easily a good title on blogs and other innovation journals. These are good, inspiring practices, I agree. But there is a lot also in more radical experiments that, in fact, remain often marginal or even, unfortunately, or even ends because of lack of resources, of financial and in terms of time. In fact, when I also wrote an article that is called The Niches as a Politics, Experimentation as the Politics of Niche. I wrote it with a colleague, Luca Bertolini. And in this article, we identify indeed four patterns of experiments, or let's four pathways of experiments. One is death, the experiment that dies somehow, that finishes and gets invisible. The other is marginalization, so experiments that remain experiments forever. So like temporary uses that are temporary forever, struggle every year to survive. Then we have the path of what we call co-optation. So experiments that are very innovative, very radical, but then somehow become large scale and involve a lot of money, and they change their nature. They change their nature and they change their goals in the time. And last, we find the experiments that are more transformative, literally those successful experiments that change deeply the way people live in cities. Now, all those four are experiments, even though we often talk only about the last two, the cooperative or transformative, because they make the news, let's say. But also the death and marginalization are very, very informative as experiment. We can learn a lot from that. So we need to be, again, very responsive to those practices, very attentive, and governments need to be very open-minded. And to do so, again, they need to listen not only to large capitals, especially technology capitals, but also to citizens that engage in experimental practices in their neighborhoods. This is very important, I think, to give a broad, to learn, let's say, from the broad repertoire of experiments that are available out there.
Thank you for sharing your own experience, also sharing your projects on the new commons and to bringing also new concepts such as anti-fragility. I mean, new concept for me that I would be very happy to keep discussing maybe in another podcast. That was very interesting. Thank you for your precious thoughts and reflections. It was an honor to have you here with us.
Thanks for listening to Urban Resilience Dialogues. We are Karina Angeloyu and Chiara Tomaselli.
Want to get in touch with us? Drop us a line at urbanresiliencedialogues@gmail.com, or you can tweet us
with the hashtag #URDialogues.
Chat to you soon.